Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, we're happy to have with us Paul Lafarge, author of The Night Ocean, published just last month by Penguin. Paul also wrote The Artist of the Missing, Hausman or the Distinction, Luminous Airplanes, and The Facts of Winter. He's received a Guggenheim Fellowship, the Bard Fiction Prize, and a fellowship from both the New York Foundation of the Arts, as well as one from the NEA. The Night Ocean is a novel that comes in many parts. At first, I thought I would be reading about the life of Marina Willett, a psychiatrist. And then I thought that the book would veer into the narrative of Charlie, Marina's husband, who's escaped from a mental hospital, perhaps to have drowned. But then I realized that we would be delving into the life and legend of H.P. Lovecraft, perhaps the most cultish sci-fi fantasy writer of all time. Before long, though, I realized that Lovecraft's erstwhile protege and literary executor, Robert Barlow, would be the subject of my studies. Finally, another character enters and upends my understanding of all that has gone before, but in a good way. Along the way, I get to revisit my ancient literary relationship with William Burroughs and my childhood fond memories with Ursula Le Guin, and joining them is a host of other real-life characters, including Isaac Asimov, one of my heroes, Edward R. Murrow, Charles Fort, Lord Dunsany, Gilbert and Sullivan, Fritz Lieber, Robert Bloch, Frida Kahlo, and Frederick Pohl. All in all, The Night Ocean, and more. All in all, The Night Ocean sucks us into a world we may have been familiar with, or perhaps not. But by the ending, which is as enticing as the beginning, we're a little better for revisiting a man, a time, and a set of circumstances that makes us a little bit wiser, and also, and serendipitously, helps us understand a little bit more of what's going on in our world today, for good or for bad. So welcome, Paul, and thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Sam, for having me.
Hey, before we get too far afield, which I can easily do, why H.P. Lovecraft, and why now?
Well, you know, this book began for me with a story that a friend told me about Lovecraft and Barlow. I was out to dinner with Robert Kelly, the poet and novelist, and we got to talking about Lovecraft for some reason. And he said, Paul, did you know that Lovecraft spent about 2 months in the summer of 1934 with a young fan named Robert Barlow? And I hadn't known that. I was very surprised to hear it because Lovecraft was something of a homebody. He was a native of Providence, Rhode Island, and he traveled a little bit, but it was very unusual for him to spend long periods of time away from home, and certainly unusual for him to spend 6 or 7 weeks with the same person. And then there was the fact that Barlow was 16 when Lovecraft went to visit him in 1934, and Lovecraft himself had just turned 43. And I thought, oh, that's, you know, that's an interesting story. I wonder what they were up to. I wonder why Lovecraft felt compelled to stay with Barlow for so long. I wonder what he thought of Barlow and what Barlow thought of him, and you know, and what they did when they were together. And I started looking into it, and I learned, you know, some things about the time that Lovecraft and Barlow spent together. But I also discovered that Barlow was a fascinating person in his own right. He was friends with Lovecraft until Lovecraft died, and Lovecraft named Barlow as his literary executor, a job which Barlow held briefly and then lost to Lovecraft's more career-minded disciples. And they kind of took the Lovecraft estate out of his care and got Lovecraft's works into print, at which point Barlow became an experimental poet in the San Francisco Bay Area. He studied anthropology at the University of California, Berkeley, with a fairly well-known anthropologist named Alfred Kraber. And he moved to Mexico City and became one of the world's leading authorities on the language and civilization of the Aztecs. And he did all of those things before he died tragically at the age of 32. He committed suicide, the cause of which seems to have been that Barlow was gay, and one or several of his students at Mexico City College, where he was teaching, were threatening to expose him. And rather than endure that, he took an overdose of sleeping pills.
It's interesting how, in the book, at first, the reader isn't quite sure whether what he's reading is the truth as literary history, or whether it's truth embellished, or whether this has really happened at all. Because when you think back to you're forgetting it those times, but when you think back to a 40-some-year-old man visiting at somebody's house who's 16 years old, and it's kind of funny how the mother, you know, doesn't quite know what to make of him being there, but accepts him, you know, being there for that 2-month period. You know, so you're not really sure whether this is something that could have really happened. And then as you go further in the book, there's other things that happen that you get confused about. And that's what's so interesting about the book, is because it becomes, as you well know, somewhat Lovecraftian as it develops. And without giving away anything or giving away any spoilers, did you ever get confused as you were writing it as to where you were confabulating fact and fiction?
Oh, not for long. Maybe here and there when I was in the heat of writing something. And it's true that when I tell Barlow's story now, you know, I got so caught up in trying to imagine what his life was like, what it might have been like when I was writing about him, that I really, you know, I formed an image of Barlow in my mind and of what his character had been. And now when I talk about him, I have to go back and check and make sure that I'm talking about what I know about the real Barlow rather than the person I invented. But the fact is that this was a real thing that happened that was very strange and that was very hard to understand. And that remains in some ways mysterious.
Do you still find it mysterious? Do you still find it strange after all this time and after all this work that you've done?
Yeah. You mean, do I find Lovecraft's relationship with Barlow strange and mysterious? I do. I really do. You know, I think even if we were to learn everything that happened between Lovecraft and Barlow, which seems unlikely, but even if we could, there would be some mystery in it, because we wouldn't know how they'd felt about each other or what had been in their minds or what, you know, how they were changed by the time that they spent together. We might be able to guess at it, but we could never know. It's, you know, the mystery of a complicated and seemingly intense emotional relationship between two people. And there's always something there which is going to be, you know, unknown, or it's going to be remain mysterious to people on the outside of it.
Well, then talk a little bit about the Erotonomicon and how it came about, because... go ahead.
Okay, so the Erotonomicon is a book which appears in my novel, The Night Ocean, and it purports to be H.P. Lovecraft's intimate diary in which he chronicles his sexual escapades, many of which are with people of color, most of which are with men or even boys. So it's a scandalous work, and it would certainly have been scandalous at the time of its publication in 1952. But again, without giving away too much about the novel, the Erotonomicon is published, and it creates a big scandal, and Lovecraft's fans and critics are outraged and, you know, start to pick apart Lovecraft's posthumous reputation, and then the authenticity of the diary comes into question. and people begin to wonder whether they are reading the real sexual diary of the famous horror writer H.P. Lovecraft, or whether some clever prankster has pulled the wool over their eyes and created a very plausible or somewhat plausible account of what Lovecraft might have been up to, which Lovecraft never saw or knew anything about.
And what's the truth? Is it a forgery? Is it real? Is it...
Well, you can look for it on the internet, but no, Lovecraft, to the best of our knowledge, never kept an intimate diary, not like that. He had a couple of presumably sexual relationships. He was married for a couple of years to a Jewish Ukrainian woman named Sonia Green, and that was the main intimate relationship in his life. Their marriage dissolved, and Lovecraft, who had been living with her in New York City, returned to Providence and moved in with his aunt. And at that point, the romantic side of Lovecraft's biography seems more or less to come to an end, except possibly with Barlow. There's, you know, there's at least the possibility that Lovecraft felt something more than just kind of warm friendship for Barlow, and there's, I would say, a stronger possibility that Barlow felt something stronger than friendship for Lovecraft.
Well, now that, you know, it's funny, I own a bookstore, and owning a bookstore, originally I would probably think that this book would be kind of like a niche book to serve a specific market, and it would be on our front table, and it's got a beautiful cover, which we can talk about, which would definitely is going to sell a lot of copies. But I would not think, other than after starting to follow your blog and then researching for the book, looking at the reviews, this thing is getting incredibly amazing reviews, and it's become, you know, like book of, as you know, book of the week, book of the month, book of the year. It's so it's going to be a mainstream. It is now, and is on my table, a mainstream book that people are buying. So what does this do to you? You're on tour now. You're talking to people now. What do the diehard Lovecraftian people feel about you? Do they feel that you're this officious interloper now, that you're treading on sacred ground, or do they welcome this kind of exercise?
Well, for the most part, if the people who are really seriously into Lovecraft feel that I'm a vicious interloper, they've been very gracious and not told me so. The book got quite a good review from the writer Peter Cannon, who reviewed it for Publishers Weekly, and he's both a Lovecraft scholar and the author of a wonderful mashup of H.P. Lovecraft and P.G. Woodhouse called Scream for Jeeves. Great book. And he knows as much about Lovecraft as just about anybody, and he seemed generally pleased by The Night Ocean. And I did what I could to represent Lovecraft fairly and accurately within the structure of the novel. So I'm not trying to grossly distort his character or the fact of his biography. And I mean, I respected those facts as much as I could, which maybe helps to convince the Lovecraft community that I'm not just an outsider, you know, coming in to trample on their writer. That hasn't been uniformly the case. There's one Lovecraft scholar and biographer who wrote me an email to say that although he'd found the book compelling, he was offended by my representation of Lovecraft, and in particular by the way that I handled Lovecraft's racism, which he felt made Lovecraft out to be more of a racist than he really was. And, you know, I think I wasn't sure how to answer that. The places in my book which deal most directly with Lovecraft's racism are actually probably the quotations from Lovecraft's own letters. So when I'm talking about his feeling about people who were not white, who are not Protestant, who are not men, the words that I'm using are Lovecraft's words.
You know, we.
But it's a sensitive issue.
Yeah. And speaking of sensitive issues, and we talked about this briefly before the broadcast, is that your book happens to have come out at a very interesting time in our nation's history, when things are happening that almost make it seem, as when I wake up in the morning, as if I'm in some different alternate reality. And your book kind of showcases that. I don't think you meant to do it when you were beginning to write the book, but you certainly see the parallels now.
Yeah. We're in a world of intrigue, and also a world that's beginning to seem sort of unreal or surreal, at least in the United States, with recent political developments.
Did you have that in the back of your mind? I mean, you couldn't have had that really in the back of your mind when you were writing this, did you?
No, I'd love to say that I foresaw all of the things that were going to happen in
Nobody
the United
did.
States when I started writing this book, but that's not the case. I did want to write a book that deals with hoaxes and with deceptions. I wanted to write a book about a character who tells a story which turns out not to be true, and then to think about what effect telling that story has on the people to whom he tells it, you know, and on the community in which it's told, and how they respond to him, and how that changes him, and kind of how that whole drama unfolds. And that does happen in The Night Ocean. And then the other thing that I wanted to think about in that connection is, well, what kind of a person does that? What kind of a person wants to pass some collection of plausible lies off as the truth? You know, why do people engage in that kind of hoaxing? And so that was another thing that was on my mind when I was writing the book. The fact that we've now ended up with an administration which seems intent on hoaxing us is, you know, a sad coincidence, although I guess it's good from the point of view of drawing attention to the book.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, going back to, I briefly mentioned the cover, and the cover has that same kind of feel, and it's not until the cover is beautiful and compelling, and being a bookseller, as many times as someone tells me you can't judge a book by its cover, most everybody who comes into my bookstore does. And this is a great cover, and I think from your blog, it sounds like you agree, don't you?
I do. I think it's a wonderful cover.
Yeah, and it really does go into so many different layers of the book, and I can't say why, because it would kind of spoil some aspects of the book. But it's when you're dealing with you're giving the reader an unreliable narrator, and perhaps more than one unreliable narrator.
Possibly.
Yeah. And that gives the reader a lot of work to do. And I always enjoy that as a reader, because it's like, I'm participating in the process. Do you have any expectations? Did you have any, I don't know, not fears, but reticence about doing this in such a way that a reader might be confused throughout the book or during a good portion of the book as to what was actually going on?
Yeah. So before I answer that question, can I just share with you a fact about the cover?
I don't know.
So I saw this was the first version of the cover that I saw. There were some previous drafts, but they didn't make it out of the design studio. So my editor at Penguin just mailed me this cover, and I said, wow, you know, I love this. It blows me away. But the arm, which is reaching out of the waves on the cover of the book, is almost exactly the same arm which appears in the illustration that went along with Robert Barlow's story, The Night Ocean. So Barlow wrote a short story called The Night Ocean in real life, and he showed it to H.P. Lovecraft, who revised it for him. And then Barlow published it in a small magazine called The Californian just a few months before Lovecraft died. And the magazine printed the story with some illustrations, and one of them has almost exactly this arm. And it was just a coincidence of design, but somehow the book designer, the cover designer, had found the arm, and here it was, coming back to wave at me.
That fits perfectly with everything we're talking about.
I thought it was just wonderful.
Yeah. So in retrospect, I mean, well, in summary, what I was asking before was, do you think you're putting too much of a job on the reader by making the narrator or narrator so unreliable that they can't be sure at any given time what's going on?
Yeah, I do worry about that. I certainly worried about it when I was writing the book, and I continue to think about it. This is a book in which the same central story, which is the story of Lovecraft and Barlow, gets told a couple of different times, a couple of different ways, and we read, you know, chapters and parts of the book which describe what seem to be real events, and then later we learn that maybe we haven't been reading about real events. So the rug keeps getting pulled out from under the reader's feet, and I worry that that would be a frustrating experience for the reader. And in a way, I think, you know, it's the nature of the book, because the book is about that experience. It's a book about what it's like to have the rug pulled out from under your feet. And there's no way to communicate that experience to the reader without making a rug and then yanking it.
Yep.
You know, that's kind of the only way to have the reader not just think about that experience, but actually have it in a way that feels like, okay, now I see what this is, and now I can think about how I feel about it. So I had to do it. I knew it was a risk, and I was encouraged when the first people who read the book, my partner, my editor, my agent, you know, came back and didn't just say, well, Paul, you've really lost your mind, and why on earth did you think anyone would read a book in which the same story keeps getting told and then revealed to be false? Because I had anticipated that reaction. I was glad that that those readers didn't, you know, react that way. And it seems, by and large, like the people who pick this book up don't have that reaction. And in part, I think it's because they understand what the book is about. You know, it wants you to be engaged with these characters. It wants you to care about them and to worry about them and to be concerned about their well-being and their future. But it's also telling you from fairly early on, look, this is a book about reading. It's a book about deception. And don't be alarmed, you know.
There was a moment, maybe there was a moment in the book when I was reading when I might have gone, hey, what's going on? What's he doing? What's going on here? And then, and it's the same word other reviewers use too, is you're sucked into. And it was funny how in reading the reviews, it's funny how many people say the words you're sucked into, which is very Lovecraftian. And it's true. You get sucked in. You go, wait a minute. Well, let me just see what's going on here. And that just keeps going on. And then I can't talk about the end of the book because you can't talk about the end of the book, but it all is like this maelstrom that just kind of leads you to this place. Talk a little bit about in the Erotonomicon, the funny part, because there's a lot of funny stuff in the book too, about the funny nomenclature with regard to the sexual acts that Barlow and Lovecraft engage in.
It really was fun to write. I think, you know, the Erotonomicon is it's a lark in a way. It's somebody having fun with the idea of Lovecraft's sex life. And, you know, saying if it had been, what would like a Lovecraftian take on sex sound like? Because Lovecraft's own stories are full of, they're very adjective heavy, and they're full of names which are difficult to pronounce. You know, these beings from beyond the stars all have names like Cthulhu and Yog-Sothoth and Nyarlathotep. And there's a lot, there's a certain amount of of purplish prose towards the climax of Lovecraft stories. And so it was fun to, you know, it's fun to imagine writing about sex using that language. And it wasn't a particularly bad fit either.
No, it wasn't. And it was actually kind of it's perversely titillating because the names of the acts were so awful.
Well, you know, you're going from one kind of forbidden experience. Lovecraft is all about, the stories are frequently touch on the idea of forbidden knowledge or forbidden activities, places where people shouldn't go, things that people shouldn't do, books that people shouldn't read. You know, there's this idea of the forbidden that runs through Lovecraft fiction. And sex is the forbidden, too, in another way. You know, it's something that certainly in Lovecraft's day it was inappropriate to talk about in public. It had a slightly forbidden feeling to it.
You know, it's funny, I haven't even mentioned the name of the one person, and I'm not going to, who really tells the story in so many different ways, because it is mentioned, his name is mentioned in other reviews and all, but it's just that how did you envision? Yeah, and oh, you know what I was going to ask you about? I was going to say Marina seems like such a nice person, doesn't she?
Good. I think the book needs a nice person.
I know.
A level-headed person. There are a lot of fans in the book, and there are a lot of fanatical people. There are a lot of people who are chasing, you know, one obsession or another.
Yeah, I think you kind of found Marina as your grounding post, I think.
Yeah, we need somebody who's outside all of that, who can cast some light on it for us without getting so caught up in it that she loses her perspective and we're completely at sea.
Yeah, and it's not that she doesn't have her problems, you know, Charlie being foremost among them, but she is grounded and she should be grounded. That's the nature of her profession. But it is nice to have her there because at least when you have her narrating, you do feel like you're attached to something.
Yeah.
It's a different kind of reading.
Yeah. And the book, you know, there's a lot in The Night Ocean which I think maybe would make a Lovecraft fan chuckle. Or, you know, there are places where the book is winking at people who've read Lovecraft. But I didn't write it exclusively for Lovecraft readers or for Lovecraft fans. I wanted the book to be accessible to people who aren't familiar with Lovecraft and who might just be interested in the idea of a story about a person who becomes obsessed with a kind of literary mystery and vanishes into it.
Well, and the reviews consistently say that. They say you don't have to be a Lovecraft reader to delve into this book at all. Which brings me to the why you decided, and Marina's the one who does this, is adding the footnotes, which tell us so much about so many other contemporaries of Lovecraft and people that, you know, since I've been reading science fiction since I was 10 years old, people that I'm familiar with, especially that rather poignant scene with Ursula Le Guin, which I guess you created out of whole cloth, right?
Not entirely.
Really?
So Ursula Le Guin is in real life, the daughter of Barlow's teacher, Alfred Kraber. The K stands for Kraber. And she and Barlow would have overlapped. Barlow was Kraber's student when Le Guin was 8 or 9, however old I have her in the book. And I emailed her and said, sorry to bother you, Ursula K. Le Guin, but do you happen to remember anyone named Robert Barlow? And she wrote back very graciously and said that she didn't have any particular memory of Barlow, but that, you know, her father had had a lot of students and he'd been close to a lot of students. And so it was very possible that Barlow had been her father's student and that she just might not have remembered it. And she also mentioned that she didn't ever particularly care for Lovecraft's work, which I included in the book. And then the rest is mostly invention, although it's invention based on accounts of what she was like as a child.
What about with Fritz Lieber and Frederick Pohl? There are all connections, correct? Definitely.
Yeah,
are.
Those that constellation of people was really just like they were there. You know, they all knew each other. Science fiction fandom was not a big world in the 1930s and 40s. And the people who participated in it were very passionate about it, and they had a lot of contact with one another. And so sooner or later, they all ended up meeting, you know, and Lovecraft was such a central figure in that world. He corresponded with dozens and dozens and dozens of science fiction fans and writers and editors. And he would have lengthy, intense, protracted conversations with these people. And then he'd introduce them to each other so that you have a community of people who are all talking to each other because they met through Lovecraft or because they shared a love for Lovecraft's writing.
And then you have William Burroughs, who at first I thought you just threw in there, but then I realized afterwards that he really did have this actual relationship and actually wrote to, was it Timothy Leary did he write to?
He wrote to Ginsberg. About
Allen Ginsberg, right.
Yeah. Burroughs was Robert Barlow's student at Mexico City College. He took a class with him on Mayan civilization. And apparently it was a class that made an impression on Burroughs because he writes quite a lot about Mayan imagery and Mayan religion and so on in his fiction.
That part was pretty funny, too.
Yeah, I mean, it was really fun to write and to try to imagine Burroughs as a character. But it was also fun just to follow these lines of, it's not historical accident, but just the lines of, of historical causality and historical influence, and to see who knew whom and who was where and, you know, how these people all fit together.
The footnotes are helpful,
they're useful for that.
Yeah, and
there are a couple of things that I kind of cheated because I couldn't think of a way to include them in the main narrative. But I really wanted to squeeze them into the book. So, for example, it turns out that Burroughs he studied with Robert Barlow, and then he went on to publish his first book with Donald Walheim, who had been a close friend of Lovecraft and who's also a character in the novel.
Yeah, and the footnotes flow along nicely because you as a reader, you at the moment the footnote appears, you tend to be wondering about, okay, who exactly is this? What exactly is going on here? And then she leads you nicely into it.
Yeah, thanks. I'm glad it works like that.
It does.
I wanted them to be actually helpful. They're not really ironic footnotes.
No.
They're just footnotes which would provide the kind of information that footnotes typically do.
Well, it's a fascinating book, and the connections are also fascinating, and I really appreciate you coming by today to talk to us about it. I honestly can say when I first saw the book and I saw the cover, I definitely wanted to read it, and then when I started, I wasn't sure about, okay, is this going to be literary criticism? Is this going to be a history of a literary icon? What is it going to be? And then as I got drawn into it, I have to use that word again. It is a vortex. You get sucked into it. And I think that's what I could recommend to almost anybody who wants to pick this book up, is that once you do pick it up, it's kind of like a one-sitting book and you can't really help it. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Sam. It was great to talk to you.
We were talking with Paul Lafarge, author of The Night Ocean, which is a fascinating story about H.P. Lovecraft, his protege, a lot of other people that are familiar to me and in all likelihood will be familiar to you. Can't really categorize it. It's not like a memoir. It's not a biography. It's not a science fiction book or a fantasy book. I wouldn't be able to put it into any genre. But it's definitely something that doesn't come along often, and it's gotten great reviews, and I really think that it's well worth taking a look at. It's definitely different. It's a novel that took a lot of thinking, and the other thing is that it also mirrors our times. And so as you read it and feelings of dread come over you, as they will, you realize that part of the reason why the feeling of dread is coming over you is that you woke up this morning and you went to Google News and you read something that's very similar to what was in the book. And the unreliable information that we receive every day from the government is very similar to the unreliable information you'll receive from the narrator of this book. But enough of that, because I could go on for days. Keep joining us. We have lots of good people coming up. There's a bunch of them that will be on by the time you've listened to this interview. But we also have Colin McCann, author of Let the Great World Spin and National Book Award winner. He's going to discuss his new book, which is a cool book. It's a little book called Letters to a Young Writer. And it's about how to write a book, and how to be an author, and how not to give up, and how to keep trying, and how to fail and fail again and keep going. And very similar to Stephen King's On Writing, which was considered or is considered one of the best books for young writers. But so if you have a desire to become an author, or someone in your family does, I would highly recommend this book called Letters to a Young Writer by Colin McCann. Letters to a Young Writer, subtitled Some Practical and Philosophical Advice. And then Lyanda Lynn Hopman will discuss her new book, which has gotten a lot of press, called Mozart's Starling, which is about the starling that's the muse to Mozart, and then coupled with a memoir about a woman who also finds inspiration from a bird as well. And so those are two interesting, thin volumes, but fascinating books that are coming up. So thanks, as always, for joining us here on The Avid Reader. Things are going great at the bookstore, by the way. What was I going to tell you? Oh, Real Simple Magazine, which has got a circulation of about 3 million and has a big web presence, just named us, Wellington Square Bookshop, as the best bookstore in the state of Pennsylvania, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. So we're very pleased about that. We've gotten awards in the past, as you know, Best in Mainline, Best in Philadelphia Magazine, Best in Philly.com, Best of the Daily Local. I could go on and on, but this being not the best of Philadelphia or the Mainline, but the best in the state, you know, we go to Oregon and you get Powell's Books, you go to New York, you get The Strand, and you go to Pennsylvania and you get Wellington Square Bookshop. I can't tell you how proud that makes me feel and how thankful and grateful I am to all of you for helping it happened by patronizing our store. So in any event, as always, thanks for joining us, and we look forward to seeing you next week here on The Avid Reader.